Teacher Breezer has about 30 years of experience in working in the field of education, and he has dedicated many of his years to getting children included in education. And Richard has actually been representing the government of the UK at the time of the preparation of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. His NGO Growth of Inclusion is actually working in different parts of the world. Argentina, Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific to actually train teachers and education administrators in this agenda. I think that Richard's main standpoint is that education, inclusive education, is just education. He will explain to us why this statement, and I think he will provoke us a little bit. Before we start going to the room, I just wanted to tell you in two words why we are here. It's because in the lab group we have a bit of cutting wood money this year to try to mainstream and raise awareness on the cross-cutting theme of disabilities. And while the theme was quite important in social protection, we really wanted to reach out to our education colleagues. I'm very pleased that Barbara, on behalf of the lab education team, has accepted to co-chair this with me. And I'll let Washington introduce themselves before we go to the meat of the presentation.
Thanks very much, Karine, for organizing this, and thank you so much, Richard, for being with us. I'm Barbara Bruns. I'm the lead economist for education in the Latin American Caribbean region, and just someone who has worked, you know, bank-wide on strategies for achieving the Millennium Development Goal. I think it's very clear to everyone in the education sector that those goals cannot be met until we and our partner countries and every school and teacher in those countries does a better job of identifying and addressing and supporting the special needs of children who aren't able to get into school or aren't able to make adequate learning progress in school. We all recognize that a big part of the core problem of achieving our goals of learning for all is that our schools are not adequately equipped and flexible in addressing the individual needs of children, all kinds of issues, be they physical, learning, cognitive, or socio-emotional issues. So I think that that's something that we're giving increasing attention to and hearing increasing demand from our partner countries for support in doing, and I think we're also, many of us, engaged in trying to build up an evidence base on what kinds of programs and strategies are most cost-effective in meeting the needs of all children. So, with that, let's go around the room, and one thing we've tried to do here in Washington is reach out to people. You know, I think most of the audience here today is from the education sector and family, but we're trying to reach out to our colleagues in health and SP, because actually this is one of those priority areas where it's really, many of us feel we need to work cross-sectorally, and we may be at some risk of not being able to do so effectively under the new structure of the bank. So we definitely want to, from the very beginning, send a signal that we're not going to allow ourselves to fall into silos and are going to reach out and address big multi-dimensional challenges such as these in a multi-sectoral way. So let's go around to my right here.
I'm Emma. I'm JPA Course Information. Course-based education.
I'm University College of London, but I'm on the development of a World Bank education project in that.
Yeah. I'm Lane, and I just recently came to social protection working on an evidence-based policy paper for people with disabilities in Latin America, and social, focused on health and education and social protection.
Mark Nicholas from the Legal Vice
formerly in the
with Charlotte McLean.
Hi, my name is Charlotte McLean, Council. I'm currently on an external service that we from the bank. I was an SP with Dan and Marco, and I'm currently the senior advisor to the UFAID.
Hi, Charlotte.
Say your words, Marco, around. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Good. You're the first person I know.
But that's good. That means we're getting new people.
We actually met going. I guess I don't
know. All right. Okay. Good.
Hello, I'm Tom Bella, and I'm with the Global Campaign for Education, and currently examining the importance of bringing children with disability into school in order to meet the goal of having all children in education.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Janet Kaduki from Africa Region, Private Sector Empowerment, and I'm also a fan of that in the UK, and I'm also an advocate of the
So my name is Doja Nova. I work on the NDC for the ACL for non-project.
I work on social protection and early childhood development, and I've been working with Kevin on LAC disability work.
Hi, I'm Helen Craig. I'm a lead HD specialist working in the Africa region. I've been working very closely with the legal BP unit on some of this last year, looking at regulatory frameworks in a number of African countries. Kenya was one of those in the last 3 years.
Hello, everybody. I'm Enrique Lacino. I'm from the country office of Nicaragua. I am a social specialist. And well, just want to learn because we have huge challenges there around this topic.
Hi, I'm Rioto Tomita. I'm the education. I was working with autistic children with intellectual disability for 4 years when I was a university student doing something.
I'm Margaret Rush. This is my advocate lead panelist for HD. It is officially multi-sectoral stuff. So I will be mapping to SP next week, and I'm missing a big meeting on my SP side because I thought I'd have to walk the walk and be multi-sectoral.
I may not just for one more day.
I need to sit with Dan and Marco next door, so to speak, in the
Thank you, Margaret, for being here.
Hi, I'm Javier Botero. I'm in the education team.
Peter Holland, also the education team.
Ahmed Hassan, education team, East Asia.
So, Richard, I just want to say that this is not the typical turnout you get in the LAC region for a brown bag lunch.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more diverse. Colleagues from literally across all of our bank regions and all of our sectors, and so it's a tribute to you and how eager everyone is to hear you present on these topics and give us guidance. So with that, why don't we get started? You can tell me, Richard, when to advance the slides, and I'll do it.
Okay, thank you very much. I've been given the title, "What Will It Take to Get All Children with Disabilities Enrolled in School?" But I think it's not only enrolled, because that's been one of the objectives, but also to complete at least basic education, which is, of course, a much harder goal. But there's a lot of evidence to suggest just pushing on access and not looking at the quality of what's going on isn't really very useful. I just wanted to say it's fortuitous today that we're meeting on the same day that the GPE have got their conference to try and get rededication of £3.5 billion for the Global Partnership on Education. And although they still haven't really taken disability into the heart of it, there are some signs around the edge of it that it's now one of the criteria in the guidelines. And just last year, I think they said that no new schools that they funded should not be made to accessibility. I think it's a little late. It's 8 years since the convention was passed, but it's a sign that at least it's now coming into the fold. What I wanted to do really was, first of all, look at some statistics, look at the framework from a disability rights point of view, see how that fits in with the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and then look at how some examples of how that's being applied, and then some lessons from that about what we need to do, but with a particular emphasis on systems and funding of what might work. Now, of the 57 million children still not in school, there are various estimates, the lowest being 33% and the highest 40%. The first from the Leonard Cheshire and the second from the Global Campaign, of the number of disabled children or children with disabilities who are not in school. And it is a paradox that the more successful we seem to be at getting children who are not disabled, including girls, into school, the greater the proportion of children with disabilities who are left in the residuary group. And that's true in many different countries. We've got different statistics. One thing we've got for sure is no accurate statistics which are globally representative, except for very general estimates. But for instance, work in Malawi and Tanzania show that children with disabilities are twice as likely to have never attended school. Burkina Faso, having a disability increases the risk of being out of school by 2.5 times. In Bolivia, it's estimated 95% of population 6 to 11 are in school, but only 38% of children with disabilities. Ethiopia, the government says it's only 3%. In Nepal, 85% of children out of school are disabled, and a similar figure is found from a quite detailed study that was done in Vietnam. So it clearly, the more detail we get in surveying number of disabled children, the more we find who are probably not in school. So we're thrown back on the sort of guide from the World Report on Disability that the World Bank and the World Health Organization produced in 2011. Which gave us an estimate of 15% of the world's population who have some sort of activity-limiting impairment, and that a conservative estimate will be 1 in 10 children, and 80% of those are living in developing countries. So they come down with the very conservative estimate of 93 million children, or 1 in 20. Now, work that I've been doing, for instance, recently in South Sudan, and yes, we would expect it to be higher there, puts it between 25 and 30%, and the surrounding countries between 14 and 17%. So this is not a small group, and it's a group that we have to do much more to accommodate. A piece of work funded by the bank a few years ago in 2008 by Filmer, looking at household surveys in 14 countries, showed a consistent gap between 30 and 60% difference across those 14 countries of children with and without disability in school. Now, we await some comprehensive work that's being done with UNICEF on statistics to try in the next 5 years to have, following the model of the Washington Group on gathering disability statistics, and that is having some success in getting countries to take it on. But I think one of the things that we should tie to any funding bid that we put on countries, that they have to take gathering data much more seriously, because we can't monitor what's going on, how successful we are, if we don't actually have data. And a scheme that was run in India by the National Resource Center for Inclusion, I thought, was a good model a couple of years ago with German funding, which looked at identifying on door-to-door surveys, but then getting those children who are identified to go for a second-tier check, and this is also the system that UNICEF are now using, with medically trained practitioners. And then the third phase of that was, once having raised the expectation with families, they then followed through, and this is often the case, not the case with surveys. We gather the data, but then we don't give anything to the people we're interviewing. I thought this was a good model, where they actually then went on to place those children out of school in school and gave training and support to the teachers and schools and used community-based rehabilitation to help the transition. So I think that model which was developed there, and which the Indian government now is now looking at developing across India, except that, of course, they're now caught in the paradox of their own success, that donors are cutting back the most on education support in India, because of their economic growth, but they're still not channeling money through to these areas. Well, for those who make it into school, there are a number of other barriers which are real problems. The quality of education is usually poor. Often, Western and Northern models of special education, which we're moving away from very slowly, of segregating children once we identify them by their impairment group and suggesting that a specialized setting is the best place to meet their needs. And incidentally, there is no evidence, I repeat, no evidence around the world to support that as an educational model. It's a model of educational failure. It's a model of social failure. It's a model that makes sure that children are not able to actually meet the needs of their social integration and develop inclusion. Now, of course, it's true that in some specialized schools, such as schools for the blind and deaf, there are good ratios, and given the lack of expertise in mainstream schools, many advocates still will argue that that gave them the best education. But if you try and generalize that across, say, in South Sudan, where we're talking about 30% of the pupils with disabilities having a vision impairment, there is no way that we could develop special schools for the visually impaired. In fact, the government of South Sudan, under the project that I've been working on, has decided that they will go for an inclusive approach when peace is re-established over a five-year program, because they just couldn't provide that level of support. It's also, the curriculum generally is not adapted, and there are worries here that pressure towards a generalized curriculum around the world could act in excluding more children with disabilities where there isn't the flexibility to adapt the curriculum to meet the needs of each and every child. In addition to that, most teachers are not trained to do flexible teaching, multi-grade teaching, as we might call it. Teachers have negative attitudes and do not feel prepared. They often have the skills, but they don't feel prepared. And this is very often, there's been quite a few studies now, a question of attitude, and therefore work, particularly with pre-service teachers, where disabled groups, disabled persons organizations have a continuing input on their training, so that the unfamiliarity of disability becomes part of their normal experience, is probably the best way that we can prepare teachers, as well as having a flexible approach in the pedagogy that they're using. We also have problems with parents who, in the standard and traditional view, don't see the point of education for their disabled child, because they look around and they only see disabled children in their society as beggars and as people out on the edges of the society. So that this huge human resource is really being wasted, and that reinforces some parental views. However, there are other parents who, once they see the model, and this can be done through, so it's good we've got people from child protection here, long before children get to school, community-based rehabilitation on the model developed since 2010, which has the social model at the heart of it, can really make those parents into advocates who become a very strong force, pressure for inclusion. Peers can also harass if we don't actually deal with disability within the curriculum and make sure that children's innate sense of fairness is channeled into seeing this as something that they must challenge themselves. Overall, even in countries with high primary school enrollment rates, disabled children are more likely to drop out of school than any other vulnerable group. There's a World Bank study in 2004 in India that showed dropout and not going to school for the group of children with disabilities in India was five times greater than other excluded and marginalized groups. So we need to build that into any programs, and I'll talk a bit later about why we need to incentivize in that area. Now, for us in the disability movement worldwide, the signing of the convention in 2006 was really a fundamental change. It had taken really 38 years to get disability included in the family of human rights documents, which is why we'd agitated away from a voluntaristic system, which showed it didn't work, to one that had to be mandatory and binding. And it's good that we've now got 147 countries who've ratified that and 158 who are signatories. And even if they're signatories, they can't do anything in their planning and in their way forward, which would go against the convention. And once they've ratified it, it has to be part of domestic law. Now, what is fundamental to this change, which many of us campaigned for many years, including collecting evidence over a number of years to show discrimination against disabled people, and in fact, we ended up with 2.4 million examples of prejudice against disabled people in order to win the world community recognizing we couldn't have a voluntary system, we needed to have something that was based in international law. And what that had to be based on was a definition of disability which was not seeing the problem in the person, but as an evolving concept that disability results from the interaction of persons with impairments, both physical and mental, with the attitudinal and environmental barriers that hinder their full and effective participation in society on an equal basis with others. It doesn't mean everybody is treated the same, it means giving people what they need in order to maximize their potential. And this paradigm shift is said by the UNDESA on their website, I think a very useful characterization here, we're not viewed as objects of charity, of medical treatment or social protection. Rather, we are subjects with rights who are capable of claiming those rights and making decisions for their our lives based on free and informed consent. Now, one of the important things here is we have very, very few DPOs that are funded as part of projects to be partners in monitoring and developing the need for, in this case, inclusive education, but also social protection measures for disabled people and rehabilitation. And really, if we want this to be good use of resources, it needs to be monitored at a local level. And who better than democratic local DPOs to actually do that? And in fact, it was Susan Peters in her really important piece of work she did for the bank in 2004 that put this forward and said, you know, there may be other interest groups, but I'm talking about this interest group, and I'm talking about it too, and they need to be a bit of positive discrimination to make sure that disabled people's organizations, DPOs, are at the heart of any change that we're trying to bring about. And I do think that much of the money that's been spent in the last 30 years, and there has been a lot of money, has been misspent because we don't have this level of control down at the community level. And I'll say more about that in a minute. But before we do, I want to characterize this shift in paradigm by what it means looking at a child, and particularly a child vis-a-vis the issues of education. Now, under the old paradigm, we would look at a child, whether they had a physical impairment, polio, paralysis, a whole range of cerebral palsy, a whole range of conditions, or whether they had a learning difficulty, an intellectual impairment, or whether they had a mental health issue, we would look at the child and say, what's the problem? Well, the problem is focused in the child. They can't get to school, or they can't get in, or around the building. They can't actually utilize what's being provided in the school. They can't keep up with the class. They don't understand what the teacher's saying, because, of course, the teacher increasingly, under our competition-driven education system, and don't get me wrong, I'm for high-quality rigor in education, but I'm not for international competitive tables, which I think cause a great deal of harm. What I am for is accountability. And therefore, teachers do want to get the best from all children, but they should be getting credit where they make progress for children who are moving at much lower rates, a grade progression, which isn't the same as everyone, because not everyone progresses in the same way. And as long as we have this model of progression of everyone at the same time, we cannot have an inclusive system. They may be bullied by other children, and in some cases, well, the child is so badly bullied they can't possibly be here, they have to be in a protective environment or home educated. They need specialist teaching, and therefore the ordinary teacher can just shrug their shoulders and say, well, I can't deal with this, I'm not trained for it. Sorry, you've been trained to educate children, and educating children with disabilities fundamentally is the same as educating all other children. There are certain techniques that you need to learn, what I call the second track. But nevertheless, in all teacher training and in all in-service teachers around the world, we need to develop this understanding that they adapt their skills to be both inclusive, but inclusive of children with disabilities. So needs to be kept away from other children. In some of the surveys we've had back in South Sudan, where there's a widespread amount of epilepsy, which seems to be linked to malaria, there's a view amongst most parents that it's contagious and they don't want their children sitting next to children with epilepsy, for instance. So that's an issue of education. They're not like the other children, so we don't really want them with us. They waste scarce resources, and then a whole load of traditional ideas, which we would think are long gone as soon as you get just below the surface in any community in the majority world, and indeed in the north, you will find these ideas that the person's the witch, evil, punishment. And just think, what's the first question people ask when a child is born anywhere in the world? Is it all right? So is that an assumption that some way someone has given a punishment or who knows? The point is, we should be as welcoming of disabled children when they're born into the world or when they acquire an impairment as any other. And that's a big, big ask and a big change in attitude. So this old model has led to, first of all, our exclusion from education around the world, our segregation in education, and if we are in education, it's really on a proviso that we can cope with what all the other children are doing, integration, not inclusion. We want to move on to this new model, which is at the heart of the convention, the social model, the human rights model, which sees the problem not in the person. Yes, the person has their impairments. Yes, they need rehabilitation. Sometimes they need medical support. So I'm not characterizing one against the other. We need to have those things in place. But if we only have those things in place, we see the child through the medical lens. Back in this, So in this second model, which we've got, we address the negative attitudes, the superstitions. We educate the community. And that means awareness raising under Article 8 of the Convention, which all states that have signed up to are meant to do, but very few have so far done. We need to challenge rigid methods of curriculum and assessment, the grade system, which is deeply embedded throughout many parts of the world and leads to children in many countries still being held back until they reach that grade. Well, some children will never reach that grade. They have to progress with their peers, and there has to be multi-grade teaching in every classroom so that teachers can develop each child. And the peer support is very important in them going forward. I know myself from having been excluded as a disabled person in my schooling that how dispiriting it is to be left out from the group that were your peers and then maybe have to make new friends with younger children because you're not assumed to be at the level of the ones who've moved on. That is not the way. We cannot do that. We have to move and challenge those barriers. We have to challenge inaccessible buildings, environments, and information. And we have to improve the quality of teaching to prevent dropout. Dropout is running at a much higher rate for children with disabilities, also those from poor backgrounds, and for girls. And we need to make sure that the quality of teaching is good, and where there is an economic issue, we need to incentivize the families to make sure that those children do stay in school and actually gain the benefit of the education. But there's no point paying incentives if the quality of what's being offered isn't good enough. So those two things must go together. We need to make this a person-centered approach. You can't have a one-size-fits-all. You have to actually identify what is it that are the functional barriers in the person. But also, having two people with cerebral palsy doesn't mean that they have the same solutions. They are 100 different ways that they may be presenting the condition. Say someone with Down syndrome, 100 different ways they may present. We can get concert pianists with Down syndrome, we can get film stars with Down syndrome, and we can get other people with Down syndrome who basically never develop literacy but maybe can become very good at interpersonal skills. So, you know, you've got to develop with the person, the people who know them, a person-centered approach rather than just this functional assessment on its own. We need to provide teachers and schools with training and support, and I'll say more about that. We need to inform and involve parents, and not just tokenistically. The involvement of parents has been shown around the world to be one of the key factors to make inclusion work. And in fact, in many parts of the world, the first pioneers to actually make inclusion work for their children have been the parents of children with disabilities. We need to reduce the cost to the pupils and the families. Although we have now in many places supposedly no fees for basic education, there are all sorts of add-on costs like tuition costs, uniform, materials. And these for poor people can provide a huge barrier, particularly of the view that there's no real cost benefit in actually their child completing this education. So we need to deal with that as well. We need to develop expertise in alternative communications, and that means developing people in every school eventually who can deal with augmented communication, braille, access to sign language, and we need to address negative attitudes. So that model is a much more hopeful model. It's one that's dynamic, it's the beginning of a process, whereas if we go back to the previous one, it is a static model which is limited by our perception of the person and their impairment. So we have to have this second model in everything we develop, because otherwise we will be falling back into the old model. Now, how does this work geographically, these models, when we map them into provision on the ground? Well, if you have an exclusion model, that you don't think the child can benefit from education, well, then they don't go to school at all. The next one, if they have to have separate education, because that's what you've inherited, and in many parts of the world we've inherited this from missionaries from the north and so on, have brought this special education model down and embedded it, particularly through charities and religious foundations. This has been a very strong emphasis, and it creates quite a big barrier, because if there's always somewhere else that this child can go, then the people in the mainstream will say, well, it's not my problem, someone else can deal with it. So this segregation model is not really helpful at all. Then we tried from the 1970s until now, and it's the dominant model where we are including children in schools, is a unit model, or where we try and include the child in the mainstream, but we don't really change the mainstream. We call that integration. The child has to cope with the school as it is. So yes, we can provide a limited amount of therapy, rehabilitation, individual support, but we don't change what's happening in the curriculum. We don't change the style of teaching, the way that teaching is being delivered. We don't change the assessment system. We expect the child to sink or swim. And this is often not swimming, often drowning, because the very simple things that you often need as an adjustment are not provided. Such as, you know, very simple things like children with sensory impairments sitting at the front of the class, support from peers, a peer support worker, and so on. So what we're aiming at, and we're a long way from that yet in most places, is, and a transition to that, is that we sometimes have resource bases attached to the mainstream school where there's an additional teacher, but the key thing here is that a child spends most of their time with their peers, not like in a unit where they're most of the time away from their peers. And finally, we move on then to all children being welcomed, and the school adapts to provide the support and makes the adjustments. So, what did Article 24 say, which is the article that deals with the convention? Obviously, in the convention, there are principles, 8 principles at the beginning, and they apply through everything throughout the convention. So, as the committee slowly gets through reports from different countries, we can see that they're putting quite a big emphasis on state parties when they report, asking a lot of questions: what progress are you making to develop an inclusive education system at all levels? And it has to be said, if we analyse the 20 or so countries that have been through that process, that they are found wanting in most cases. The development by persons with disabilities of their personality, talents, creativity, as well as their mental and physical abilities to their fullest potential. The right to be delivered within an inclusive primary and secondary education system from which disabled people should not be excluded. That also is not happening. If you take India, which had made huge steps forward, but their program that they developed was that for those with more severe impairments, they would be home educated, which means a visit once a week of a tutor, and they don't get the benefit of being with their peers. Now, this is many children with simple physical impairments or conditions like cerebral palsy who, with the right accommodations, would benefit enormously from moving into the mainstream school. Reasonable accommodation is a key concept here, and this is to be provided individual requirements, support provided in individual programs. But in many parts of the world which have disability discrimination legislation, the provision of reasonable accommodations is an anticipatory duty, and I think we need to argue for legislation which does this, so that we don't go back to square one each time a new child arrives in a school. Oh, we've not had someone like you, so we've no idea what to do. By having it as an anticipatory duty, it's built into the planning. Yes, there will be some blind children eventually in the school. So, for instance, when we're spending a lot of money on printing textbooks, as again an example from South Sudan, DFID have just paid for 10 million textbooks to be printed there. Not a single thought in the consultants, this is only 1.5 years ago, that should there be any braille copies or anything on audio tape or any easy read. This should be fundamental when we are actually developing resources for schools, not as an add-on afterthought, but as part of what we're doing. So instruction in Braille, sign language, and alternative augmented communication. The employment of disabled teachers. And when I did some work for UNICEF last year, I put forward the target that we should be aiming for 5% of teachers to be teachers with disabilities, because their experience is vital for the school to develop understanding of the adjustments that are needed, but it's also important for young people growing up to see that there are people with disabilities who hold roles of responsibility in society, and they can be their mentors and help them and support them. So we need to do some positive action there on courses to say, even if your criteria of, because inevitably disabled young people in the school system don't do quite as well because of the barriers, we will allow a proportion of disabled people who qualified from school, even at the lower grades, to come into teaching, because we know that they will catch up and become very vital teachers. We need to train professionals and staff who work at all levels of education. Such training shall incorporate disability awareness and the use of appropriate techniques and materials, and that's in the convention as well. And then lastly, Article 8, which I mentioned. And this means that every child throughout the world in their curriculum needs to have some understanding and knowledge of what disability is. Disability isn't an individual tragedy. Disability is not something that happens to you because your parents did something wrong. It is part of the human condition. It has always been part of the human condition. The statistics tend to suggest in our more complex world it is getting greater rather than less, and it is the reaction of most people in society, even if they have a patronizing or charitable view to us, is basically to see us as other. And it's really why we have to work with young people throughout the world in their mainstream curriculum, is to get rid of that in the way that we have challenged sexism throughout the world, the way that we are challenging racial and ethnic discrimination, and the way that we are failing currently around the world to challenge discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation, with an increase in countries utilizing that prejudice. So here we are saying let's concentrate on disability, but it's a vital part of the work that we need to do in any school. Now, when this was passed, the IDA, the International Disability Alliance, which is the main 8 organizations around the world representing disabled people at the UN, made a comment, and they said, special needs or special education was on purpose not mentioned in this convention. And when we were drawing it up, that was a conscious decision, because that takes us back into the old model. We don't want an ideology of deficit. We want reasonable accommodations, personal programs, and access and training. That's what we want, and that's what we need for mainstreaming. And they go on to talk about why that would not work. I'm not going to read that out. It's there for people. But they argue that as soon as you develop the special education model, you are othering, you are using a deficit approach. And I agree with what they say. And then we need to make sure that all teachers get this disability equality training delivered by conscious and trained disabled people, so that they understand the difference in these two routes. So when I was doing the work for UNICEF on training teachers around the world, funded by the Australian government, a couple of years ago, it's on my website, the document, if people want to have a look at it. I found there was a real problem around the world and why we were not making progress, in that we hadn't identified clearly that actually if we want inclusion to work, it's no good just having a general thrust like in the UNESCO guidance in 2009, inclusion for all. Because if we just push on inclusion for all, we are leaving out the specific adjustments that teachers and others need to have to accommodate the particular needs, the reasonable adjustments, and the support program of individuals with different disabilities. So on the first track, and this is often lacking, so for instance, I'm going to show you an example in Zanzibar of very effective second track work, but a recent critique by INET of that suggests that what they fail to do is have this first track. So they're not actually running an inclusive system for all. They're not having ethos and equality valuing difference. They're not having barriers identified, solutions found. It's not particularly child-centered. It's not peer collaborative. It's not differentiated. It's not a flexible curriculum assessment, stimulating learning materials, or an anti-bias curriculum. It's not reflective, although a little bit now, of collaborative teachers, and it's not quality requiring rigor and effort for each child to achieve their potential. What there is quite a lot of work on what you need to do for blind and visually impaired students, braille, raised surface diagrams, mobility training, hearing, we need to have visual materials, deafblind, we need people to know deafblind language, speech and communication, we have certain adjustments that we need to make, such as repetition, breaking things down into small steps, which also works for people with specific learning difficulties and general learning difficulties. And we need adjustments for physical impairment. Often the physical impairment is about where the child is seated, how they're seated, can they work, can they go to the toilet in the school, have they got a network of friends, are we consciously building around those young people peer support, because if they're isolated and lonely, then we know that they're not going to learn as well as they should be. So mental health issues, which is a big issue that's largely been overlooked and tends to be put in the box of behavioral or disruptive behavior, but usually there's an underlying reason why children are behaving in that way, and we need to have much more skill in our schools, counseling, support, person-centered approaches to deal with that. And then the general cognitive impairment, which Inclusion International have done a great deal of work on, and are absolutely clear that the route for that is to include children in the mainstream, but it is to break down into small steps, to have lots of visual material, to have peer support, repetition, and of course, if you're pushing and rushing for the grades, then you're not necessarily going to be able to do that. There's a whole range of children with medical needs, such as epilepsy, asthma, malaria, and so on. We need to have adjustments that meet them, such as children being able to sleep some of the time they're in school, so that their attention is there when they actually need it. And we need to have the skills at every school level to be able to screen and identify. This doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a medical practitioner. It means you have to ask the questions, what can't the child do, what is their impairment, and how can we make adjustments to that? If we feel they need more support, then we need at the district level, and this is where a link up with social protection and health comes in, we need to have people who can screen and identify. But that should not lead to them going on a separate route. Once we're there, it should feed back into the school system to provide the support and advice to the teachers. So a few examples from around the world of where there are glimmers of things working. I was struck with this project in Mumbai, where ADAPT managed to develop 17 early years preschool settings, 3 to 6 year olds, in Dharavi, a slum of 1 million people. And what they did there was to utilize the resources that were already there. So these classrooms were made in the slum, in the back rooms of the slum. People gave up a room, and that's where 30, 40, 50 children came, and they said, everybody's welcome. They went and worked the parents who said, oh, my disabled child can't go there. The parents of non-disabled children said, well, I don't want them with mine. And they, as they were doing it, they did an attitude survey over 3 months, and they demonstrated that just in a three-month intervention, all those attitudes changed. They recruited the nursery workers from the community, and they trained them in using resources from the community, like matchboxes, socks into glove puppets, plastic bottles into little statues, bottle tops for accounting, matchboxes for number work, and so on. So very little expenditure, rather utilizing the resources that were there. And this is one of the big things I learned from this project. We shouldn't waste a lot of money in bringing in Western resources into low-income countries. We should utilize the resources that are there to actually develop pedagogic materials. This has now been taken up by the government of India and is running across the whole country, and I think has been a very important point. So often it's NGOs who show the gap and do it, but we have to be looking for the useful projects that the NGOs develop and then taking them up to scale with government and supporting and funding. I mentioned Zanzibar. Again, I said the criticisms, but it was a big achievement. 20 pilot schools, then doubled to 40 out of only 420 schools, now 86 running as inclusive schools, 144 teachers trained in Braille and sign, 2,225 trained in inclusion. They've got inclusion training centres for governors and parents as well as teachers, providing aids and equipment. That's a problem. This is stuff coming from Norway, expensive and difficult. So that's a limiting factor of this project. But they did work from bottom up, and it was utilizing really community networks to start with, not starting with the teachers and the schools, starting with ZAPAD, which was the organization of people with developmental disability, probably the place you wouldn't start in most places, but they said, these are the most excluded, we will start with them, and they managed to get 1,000 of those young people into education, including training, who weren't there before, utilizing the existing social networks and then working up through the local chief, to the head teachers of the schools, to the Ministry of Education. But the core of it was these networks of people using what's in the jargon called the social capital, social networks. And I think there's a lot more we can do in that area. It cannot be done by experts, but you do need facilitators. And we find that people trained in community-based rehabilitation are very much the people who can be the catalyst for making this happen. Brazil, I think, is interesting. Huge country, some positives. They've got the policies. They've got some things that are saying they need to move forward. But, you know, if we look at the figures, the government say there are 654,000 disabled children in school, but that's out of 55 million. So even on the 10% basis, we would be talking about 5 million. So where are the other children? And why don't we know what's happening to them? Maybe lots of them are in school, but their needs are not identified, and many of them may not be going to school because of community and parental pressures. But that said, the progressive policies of the government over the last nearly 20 years has been funding things. So we've been making schools accessible. We've had training running in municipalities, over 1,300 municipalities, starting with the people who administer rather than the teachers, so the administrators know how to organize things. And so we are now, as of 2011, and it's probably gone up since then, 30,000 resource rooms in mainstream schools to support the learning of disabled children. That's quite an achievement, and that's a good model which we need to think. But what we don't know and what we lack in a lot of these things is really effective follow-up studies to evaluate and say, how good was this, what were the gaps, and where should we go forward? So I think there is a mixed picture coming across there. And then utilizing community groups like ASNIC in Nicaragua. We've got someone with Nicaragua who probably knows much more about this than I do. In Managua, for instance, have been working with support from a UK funding agency to develop educational disadvantaged children with disabilities into school. Working on several fronts, for example, drawing attention to situations through mass media, which I think is always important. Link disabled people's organizations to education ministry and empower teachers. So I think that's a good practice point. The main focus of this is approach in raising awareness, and they have a local advocacy strategy and priorities. So I think that's another example. I'm going to speed up a little bit. I'm looking at the clock and I'm going too long, but there's other things happening in Nicaragua, like Los Pepitos, which has been doing a lot of work in a number of municipalities, what we need in countries like Nicaragua is somehow to get all of these initiatives together and try and bring them into a national strategy and see where the gaps are. I was struck with this project in Colombia, where the mayor was elected in 2009 on saying we are going to tackle poverty and particularly those who are excluded, including those who are disabled. So they started using a geographic approach, social geography, of mapping where the deprivation is and then concentrating in those areas where the most deprivation is to get children into school, to work with parents, and I think that was a really useful example. This, I would say, is an example when we're talking about social protection. This is a project that was done by a media organization, MIET, which is operating in Africa, and this was in KwaZulu-Natal, which is the poorest part of southern Africa, and the schools as centers of care and support. So this isn't just about disabled children. The situation in KwaZulu-Natal is many, many children are looked after by their grannies. Their parents have either died of AIDS, HIV, or have gone to work in the main urban centers, and so the grannies are left looking after them. And so they empowered the grannies by having a center in each of 12 schools where there were computers, where they could use people to be educated, they could educate the teachers, and they worked with social services and health to identify all the children in that locality who were failing and brought them back into school and gave them support. And it seemed to me, for a small amount of resource, which is funded by the Dutch government in this case, they made a huge amount of difference. Pilot, which was in Uglo, which was one area of KwaZulu-Natal, was then upscaled to a whole number of different areas. I've got the next slide is of just to show that this is possible for older children. This is in Alberta, which, yes, is a rich country. But sometimes it's said, well, how can you possibly have children with learning difficulties or young people with learning difficulties in further and higher education? Well, this is a college where in Alberta for schools, it's not particularly inclusive, but they decided under the influence of one or two pedagogues who said, no, we're going to have an inclusive college. They have been taking now consistently the whole range of children in the 16 to 18 range and graduating them, all right, at their own levels. And it shows that it's about the mindset of those who run education. It's not about the young people. Okay, I'll go on to the next one. So where do we end up with all of this? Definition of inclusion. This is the UNESCO definition, which you'll probably be aware of. It sees inclusive education as a process of addressing and responding to diversity of needs of all learners through increasing participation in learning cultures and communities and reducing exclusion within and from education. It involves change and modification in content, approaches, structures, and strategies. Excuse me a minute. I've got about 5 minutes more, and then I'll be 5 to 6 minutes more. It involves changes and modifications with a common vision which covers all children. So what's important there, it involves change and modification in the content, approaches, structures and strategies. Not changes in the individual, changes in the organisation. And that's where we've been falling down in many of the projects that we've been trying to fund. The next slide, which was a paper given by Professor Melenko at the UNESCO conference in 2008 in Geneva, he, drawing on wide work on inclusion around the world, identified four strands that he thought was important for us when we're focusing on it. You don't ever finish inclusion. It is a process with no end. We are just trying to improve it on and on and on. But therefore, it's important to get good indicators that show progress. It's concerned with identification and removal of barriers, as I've been saying. It's also about presence, being there, participation and achievement of all students. So often I come across schools and the schools say, well, we're not ready to have these children yet, so we won't take them. My view is if they're not present, then their participation never happens and the teachers and others around the school never learn how to develop their achievement. So that isn't the way. We need to follow this. We need presence, participation, achievement of all, not all at the same level, going back to my point about graded learning, but at individual personal progress. Inclusion also involves a particular emphasis on those groups of learners who may be at risk of marginalisation, such as disabled children or children with disabilities. So inclusion is not a one-size-fits-all, as it's so often been characterised, but it's a process of community building, bottom-up empowerment. So some points, really, next slide. How would this look in a school? Well, we need to move away from the teacher feeling disempowered to bringing in everything and anything that supports the development of the relationship between the child and the teacher. We won't usually in most poorer communities have as much of this, but we have in quite a lot of places some way of getting transport to school. We've got community-based rehabilitation. We've certainly got friends, brothers and sisters. We may have a specialist on HIV/AIDS. We've got disabled people's organizations in most places. We often don't have therapists, but if we have them, we can use them. We may have specialists on behavior, but we may not. We've certainly got volunteers all over the world. We've always got a Ministry of Education, but it's often not connected with what's going on down at this school level. We have the municipality, and more often is likely to be included, but maybe if it's jumping to the tune of the ministry, rather than looking at what's coming from the bottom up, we have problems. We need multidisciplinary assessment from medical practitioners, CBR, whatever. We have a head teacher or a principal in every school, so they need to be leading this process. We can have a parents group in every school. We can have NGO representatives or finance representatives, not just working at the national level, but down at the local level, monitoring how money is actually being utilized. And in many places, we need someone who knows and is checking for the child protection issues of orphans, particularly in areas with high levels of HIV/AIDS. And we need social workers all working with the teacher. And this is a more of a school-based support group approach that we were taking. So that's a model I would say we can move forward on at the school level. So now, lastly, let's look at the financial issues that are coming out from this analysis. So there are some positives we can draw up on a balance sheet looking around the world. First of all, the convention exists and it's there. It's a tool that can be used and it's part of the family of conventions that we have in the UN that we need to actually be basing all our policies around. Many NGOs, and there are, if you want to see a good number, there are about 180 examples in the book I did for the Commonwealth 3 years ago. That's on my website as well. All different scales. There are many examples of NGO-initiated things. But what is lacking is scaling up. There's been some scaling up in India, Brazil, and South Africa, maybe a few other countries. But by and large, governments tend to leave it to NGOs, and NGOs don't have the ability to scale up projects, even if they work. And if they do it, it's a very short-term funding, which won't work. It has to be longer-term funding. We know what to do to make inclusive education work. It has to be child-centered and flexible and those other things I mentioned. We know to train all teachers in the twin-track approach, yet very, very few of the 10,000 places that train teachers around the world are using this model at the moment. They're either using inclusion as an afterthought, which is about everybody included, or they're doing very specialist SEN stuff, usually a option. What they're not doing is providing these skills for all pre-service trainers, and then we are certainly not doing it for all in-service teachers. We know all schools need to be accessible. Good from last year, DFID have now said they won't give any grants to anywhere where the new school is not to international accessibility standards, GPE as well, but we need to get that in many more donors as a precondition. CBR has convinced many parents that children with disability have a right to education, but it seems to be a marginal thing around the edge of CBR and it needs to become a much more central thing. We know that bottom-up change works, wider awareness of finite resources and the delicate balance with the ecosystem and the need to collaborate not just on inclusion but on meeting many of the other issues in that we find in the marginalized parts of the world, on ecology, on poverty, and so on, which really need to be integrated. Now, on the negative, the amount of money which we're giving has fallen, has dropped by 16%, 6% 2010-11, and a further 3% in 2012, hence the conference today to try and get some more money dedicated. But even if they get that 3.5 billion, it's not enough. When I did the Commonwealth book, I calculated we would need another third on top of the ordinary estimate of money, which was 16 billion extra, in order to make sure we had the infrastructure to include all children with disabilities. So it isn't a zero cost thing. It will cost extra, but we need to build it in, but it's a one-off cost. Once it's there, it will actually have benefits in terms of GDP growth, if that's what we want, in terms of inclusion, in terms of social capital. We have a shortage of trained teachers, 1.6 million new needed to replace the existing ones, 5.2 million, and all of those will need this training. We have a dropout and non-transition to secondary, which is far too high, not just for this group, but for those in poverty, for girls and other minority groups. We have stereotyping and discrimination that still rise throughout the world. We need governments not developing comprehensive plans and approaches who are not. We need them to develop these plans. We've got too much top-down change, which often